Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is William Dixon. I'm here, of course, with Microsoft from the Microsoft Cybersecurity team. I have a couple other folks up here, which I'll introduce in a minute. I wanted to say that this particular talk is actually brand new material that you haven't seen before. It's not public, except now, as we go through this talk. Steve and Joe and I are practitioners. I'm an architect on the cybersecurity team. I've been on the team since its beginning. We actually do the technical delivery and the solution design. While this might seem a little bit kind of salesy because it's going to be high level, we're talking about different kinds of security solutions, we really are the technical folks that help design the solutions and deliver them. With that, let me start off with Steve. You want to introduce?
Hello, everybody. I'm Steven Dodson. I work in the cybersecurity IR team. I'm on William's team, and I've been doing this for 11 or 12 years now at Microsoft.
Great.
Yep. Joe Patterson, senior premier field engineer out of Atlanta, Georgia. I've been working with the Windows platform for Microsoft since 2003. Focus is on Active Directory and also security technologies. I'm also the master trainer for the offline assessment for Active Directory security internally for Microsoft.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Joe. As I said, this is brand new material, and we're pretty excited to be able to talk about this because it took a long time for us to get it together. One of the reasons is because we're moving to one Microsoft Services. While we originally titled this slide as Getting the Most Out of Your Premier Agreement, what we realized is there's actually we're moving towards a direction where there's very little difference between Premier and traditionally Microsoft Consulting Services to be one Microsoft Services. Can I see a show of hands of anybody who has a Premier agreement already, just so I have a sense? Pretty much everybody? Awesome.
Great. Yeah.
Can I see a show of hands then of those who do not have a Premier agreement who might be interested in what Premier is all about? One? Okay, perhaps.
All right.
All right, very good. We wrote the entire talk just for you.
Yeah. Congrats.
That's great. We'll get started. On the cyber team, we've seen a lot of different attacks. It's actually a top requirement that we not talk about any customer specific cases. Nothing is actually mapped to a customer. However, in this particular case, we had to come up with some type of example. These are all real examples, but they do not represent any one particular customer. That's why we call it a tale of many companies. We do see all kinds of attacks, not just malware, but really our team was created to focus on targeted attacks, targeted attack defense, and detection. In those type of cases, mostly we see information theft, stealing of documents, persistent control inside networks. We also see, in some cases, total devastation, but I mean, system wipes. There have been a couple of public examples, but I'm just going to avoid any customer names just to be safe. There's a lot of private examples. Okay, our example today is under the name Wingtip Toys. That's a Microsoft fictitious name. It's certainly intended to be, and I'm assured that it is, so that's fine. This is a realistic scenario. Imagine a couple of weeks ago, we had the IE Zero Day on Monday come out as a security advisory. In the case of this advisory, the Wingtip staff took a look at it and said, "Well, gosh, there's no patch for it. It's just an advisory. So we're going to deploy the mitigation," which was to block access permissions to a particular DLL that loaded with Internet Explorer. "And so we're going to do this in a GPO as described in the advisory and deploy that throughout our domain." You can sort of keep track, and maybe some of these cases would happen in your network, maybe not. Just keep track and see if anything here would apply to your situation. In this particular case, their Active Directory wasn't working as well as it probably should. They had a replication problem, and so that particular mitigation didn't get to all systems, right? Didn't get to a particular site because of replication delays, or replication block, in fact. As you may have been watching in the news, attackers have, because it's tax season or just after tax season, have been focused on HR departments. By that, I mean they're phishing with targeted emails. Has anybody seen people's internal corporate email, on perhaps social media sites? Could be on, "I'm an admin at such and such a company," or, "I'm in the HR department." They've got that out there on a public discussion forum or potentially LinkedIn or Facebook or what have you. Has anyone seen those kinds of examples where people are using their corporate credentials? It's particularly bad if they say, I'm an admin at, okay, because they're just raising their hand to be attacked with an email, phishing email. So in this case, the HR departments, in our particular case, they received an email about a registration opportunity for a health conference, and on that registration site, they've got a PDF that they have to download and basically learn more about it. So a very believable email, so they clicked on it, and then, of course, the attack, if they're vulnerable, and they were vulnerable because they didn't quite have all their patching together, they weren't able to push out some of the older patches that they should have. And so even an already fixed vulnerability did not make it to this system, and so they ended up being compromised. Some customers have very fast patching policy, and they think, we're okay. Some customers know that maybe they patch every 30 days, or maybe every 90 days, or maybe once a year. It's actually not that uncommon. MSRC has some really interesting statistics about how often people patch Office and patch Windows. But in this particular example, let's just say they were 30 days out of date, and targeted attackers are known to reverse engineer Microsoft Security Bulletin, Microsoft Security patches. So when we release the patch, they get started right away, they reverse engineer the patch, and we estimate somewhere in the order of maybe 10 days, they've got a working exploit. It could be even faster if they're a really good attacker. So if you're not patching within 10 days or patching, if you listen to the Australian Defense Department recommendation, they say patch your applications and patch your operating system within 2 days. 2 days for security critical patches to defend against targeted attacks. So that's, again, what we're kind of after, right? Or what we're trying to achieve is defense against targeted attacks. If the attack takes over the browser, or the Word document, or the PDF reader in this case, then it's going to run as a regular user. And you might think that a regular user, compromising a regular user really doesn't give that much information. But it gives a lot of information about Active Directory. Most users have full read on Active Directory. They can see security groups. They can see objects, group policy and so forth. They can certainly see lots of information in their own email. And if you get control of a regular user account, you can certainly see what the user types, so you can steal their credentials. And more and more and more, in fact, in almost every single targeted attack case, we see credential theft as the primary way in which attackers get further control and then stay in the network. So in this particular case, the user was also local admin. That's often, it's pretty common. And so an attack at a user level is able to take over the system. So if you were in the session prior to this session, led by Mark Simos and Nick DiCola, also on our team, it's a pass the hash defense session, a mitigation session. And we've been very, very active in trying to help prevent this attack and mitigate this attack with infrastructure solutions. But it's quite devastating, because if some type of malicious code can take over the operating system, they can steal things that the operating system knows about, which are service accounts, interactive logins. For example, if help desk remotes in, then they can steal the help desk account or steal a service account. In this particular case, once they're admin, if the code is the malicious code is admin, it can knock out the AV and pretty much just load whatever tools they want with impunity. So this is not necessarily detectable by an end user. So as I mentioned, the pass the hash attack is an attack where you can steal service accounts that run as a domain account. In this particular case, Wingtip had a domain admin service account running on all systems. Now, you might think that's unusual. Maybe in your case it's not, but I've seen it many times, where every single client and server in the organization has a service account that runs as domain admin. All right. So what that means is that any compromise of one client or one server can then, as a result of becoming local system, they can steal the service account and then take over the entire domain. So one compromise to domain admin compromise sometimes can be very quick, really without much effort at all. Depends on how the environment's deployed. So once they steal the service account, they often steal local admin accounts. Think if you have a common enterprise image. They all have the same local admin password, probably. And if you don't randomize those passwords, they all have the same local admin password. So if I have an infection on Steve's machine, then the same local admin password might apply to my machine, and now the attacker could just move laterally between clients. Okay. Click. All right. Once the attacker has control, now they can just literally do a net copy of tools, They can compromise antivirus and other systems, potentially with PSExec, and really just start moving around as they want to because they have a lot of power, either local admin on a lot of systems or they have domain admin. Okay? So we're going to take questions sort of in the middle here at the end. End of this particular example. So let's hold questions for a second, but do take note of your questions because we want to make sure we answer them as we go. All right, so let's say the patch comes out as it did a couple of days later, but the company says, well, we've already deployed our mitigation, so we're going to wait until our 30-day patch cycle to deploy. And that gives the attacker, of course, they've already got control, but now they're going to solidify their control. They're going to move and put custom implants that they've designed to, you know, infect that customer to evade their antivirus on a server in the HR department because that's where they want to be, on a client in the HR department, and really just go after that W-2 information for employees, right? Because they want to file fraudulent returns and, of course, get the check. And you might think that's hard to do, but I guess from what I hear, it's fairly easy to do. And many accountants across the U.S. anyway have been struggling with fraudulent returns for their customers. Okay, so once they get a hold of the domain controller, generally speaking, we see the attackers put tools on the domain controller to dump what's called the ntds.dit file. That's an Active Directory database of all the accounts. It has hashes of passwords. Of course, the downside of stealing that is now they have a hash of all accounts in Active Directory. And if you have a hash of all accounts in Active Directory, that means you can use special tables that are out there in the criminal world or the state-sponsored world that have pre-computed all possible hashes for, say, 8-character passwords or 9-character passwords. So if you had an 8- or 9-character password, it didn't matter what it is. It takes them no effort to crack it, so to speak. They just look it up in the table. So it takes billions and billions of entries, of course, but if they've already pre-computed it all, they just look it up. So cracking passwords isn't what it used to be, especially for shorter password links. Okay. So eventually, hopefully, the customer will detect this something's going on. In this particular case, I'll use an example where maybe a domain controller service crashes, and that becomes, you know, unusual. Domain controller services don't normally crash. One particular domain controller service started crashing, and they noticed, and they said, something's going on in this machine. Maybe they ran one of the publicly available command line tools for anti-malware defense. Maybe they didn't have an antivirus package on the DC at all. And then, you know, detected some of these tools and said, wow, someone's been on our domain controller, and we see these tools. So right away, they know they have a domain admin compromise, which means the attacker controls everything in their Windows environment. It doesn't mean they've lost control, but that doesn't mean, you know, the attacker's had a chance to do anything bad or that the attacker really intended to do anything bad other than just steal information, which, depending upon your business, might be bad. Other companies, you know, at least they didn't wipe you out, and they could have. Okay, so if you detect this kind of attack, what we see most customers doing is simply just resetting accounts, right? They reset the domain admin password, they reset a service account password, and they just kind of go on. All right, does this sound at all familiar? Is anybody kind of tracking me? Some head nods, maybe, a little bit? Okay. Well, let me turn it over to Steve and Joe, and let's look at this same situation where, you know, maybe we're going to use some different types of security services that you could get under Premier or even not under Premier to help defend. So if we follow this a little bit further, once you reset the accounts, the attacker still has an implant, so they just re-steal the same account back again. Now, you know, if you engage a third party, typically third parties are going to come in and they're going to trace the attacker through the network. They're going to send typically two people on site, and they're going to start analyzing. And, of course, it takes a very long time to start analyzing these things and, you know, track, you know, this server to that account and so forth. So they're going to be on site for 4 to 6 weeks, maybe longer, maybe several months, trying to figure out what exactly happened. When they're done, they give you all the results, but most companies aren't in a position of advising you and helping you actually implement recovery. So, you know, as a result, what happens, things just kind of drag on. So I got a little bit ahead of myself now. So in any case, we're going to start with sort of reviewing this situation, the exact same situation, and see how things might have been different with Wingtip. Okay?
Yeah, so as William was saying, the next set of scenario assumes that Wingtip Toys actually had a Premier agreement, so they have access to a lot of different offerings that might be able to help them out here. The first one I want to talk about is MSRI. And we're going to throw a lot of acronyms at you. I'll try to explain them as we go along. Throughout the presentation, we'll cover them so that you're aware of them. But the Microsoft Security Risk Assessment could have been run at Wingtip Toys, which would have provided them some background information about where they're vulnerable and where they're not, so where they're doing well, where they're not doing well. And that provides a lot of information to the users, to the customer as to their environment from a holistic view. Also, I saw a lot of hands for Premier agreements. Have you all been receiving proactive emails from your TAMs? Y'all see those, right? So this is a big service. You sort of get a heads up if you're not watching or maybe you're busy with other things. You also will get this heads up preemptive email from your TAMs and even a call from them if it's big enough to say, you need to look at this. This is something big. So this is a benefit to you all, is having another set of eyes looking at that from your technical account manager. Also, Wingtip Toys could have run an Active Directory RAP as a service, or an AD RAS as we call it now.
Next.
They could have run an AD RAS, and the AD RAS would have identified that their Active Directory replication was causing problems. Therefore, any mitigation steps they thought they had deployed were not happening. But in this case, we'd have known about this months before and fixed the problem ahead of time. So that's the AD RAS, which would have definitely helped in this case. How many of you all have heard of EMIT, or the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit? Okay, good. The numbers are increasing. When I first asked that question, it used to be like none. So at least now we're starting to get some good momentum on that. So, and real quickly, just sort of a show of hands, is it easy to deploy throughout your environment? You're all seeing it's working well? Is it just limited deployment, working good? Okay, awesome.
Is anybody actually using it? Did I see hands there? So a little bit?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, EMET.
Free download from Microsoft.
Yeah, and we'll go into a lot more detail on it towards the end. On that. But in case you want more information or you want to learn how to deploy it, we also offer EMIT deployment assistance through Premier Contract. So if you're curious about specific mitigation strategies, deployment, group policy, et cetera, we have that. So, Joe?
Yeah, so patch management, really big. Probably your first and easiest line of defense. A lot of people do it. Unfortunately, not a lot of people do it well. Microsoft has services to help you with that. The big thing is to get training. We have at least two products that can help you with patch management. Windows Server Update Services, which is built in the OS when you've got 2008 and newer.
Next. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. As well as System Center Configuration Manager, which has the software updates components. We have workshops for both of these, which include hands-on labs, so you get your IT staffs trained. Now they know how to deploy and manage and report on the status of clients and patching. In addition to that, we have the POPSUM, that's the proactive update engagement, which helps you to take these technologies after you've been trained on them, and we sit down with you, and we help you optimize for your environment, as well as ensure that the reporting is working optimally, and that you understand how patch management should work. The other thing to consider, what WSUS, does Microsoft-based updates. SCCM software update component can update software that's non-Microsoft, third-party software, whether that's, say, Photoshop or Adobe products as well. In addition to that, if Wingtip had engaged Microsoft Premier Services before this had happened, we have another offering called the Offline Assessment for Active Directory Security. Some of you may have had an Active Directory Security Assessment in the past. This is the next generation of that offering. We look at over 800 items in relation to Active Directory Security. These include settings on the domain control operating system, things happening within Active Directory service. It also includes a survey component on how you actually do your Active Directory and security operations related to Active Directory. So that's an assessment service. In addition to that, we have a remediation service called Hardening of Active Directory using Security Compliance Manager, where we take the output from the OADs and then help you harden your domain controller security settings as well as Active Directory configuration so that you are less vulnerable to attacks and thefts.
So one of the most difficult things to defend against is this peer-to-peer type of copy, right, from when the clients are compromised on one side. So Steve was actually helped design what's called the securing local lateral account movement. So Steve, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so if you go to a lot of the sessions, you'll hear pass the hash a lot, and it's definitely one of the attack vectors we see. Part of the best strategies to thwarting pass the hash style attacks, step one is to prevent the what's called lateral movement of accounts. So how many of you all have built computers where the local administrator has the same password across all machines? Yes, exactly. If that's the case, you need this type of solution, right? And so the SLAM solution is designed to randomize all the passwords and securely store that inside a protected attribute inside of Active Directory. We also do some side-by-side discussions on remediation as far as account restrictions, group policy object restrictions, so that you do items like access his computer from the network, as well as some firewall items as well. And that's SLAM. We'll talk more, a little bit more in detail on SLAM a little bit further down the line.
Yeah, let me pause right here and say, as for the folks that have Premier agreements, have you heard about all these offerings already? Because a lot of times folks haven't heard about the security offerings. I'm just curious.
Some?
Okay. I mean, ADSA, Active Directory Security Assessment, was the old name. We just renamed things, and we're using the new name, so it's been a little challenging for us, too. So Offline Assessment for Active Directory Security is the new name. And it's offline, of course, because no data leaves the network. We do it all on site. Right. Okay, well, that's good. We're going to continue on, and then we're going to sort of drill into some of these in detail. Okay, let's look at the next set of attacks and how they could have been prevented.
So that's you, actually.
That's
you're
me.
Up. Yep. You're up, sir.
Do you have the slide? Okay, good. Okay, so one of the first things that the cybersecurity team needed to do was be able to find attackers, and figure out how to get them out of the network, and then keep them out. So the finding the attackers is called Persistent Adversary Detection Service, PADS. That is a proactive check. It's 5 days. It's 4 people on site for just 5 days, and we can look across 50,000 systems. So that's actually very different than what most intrusion detection companies do, where they send a couple people and they start doing, per-box forensics. We run tools across every system in the domain and try to figure out what are all the compromised accounts, what are all the compromised systems, machines, so that you have a really good picture of what the scope of compromise is. If you don't have that, then you're really not going to have a successful recovery. So that's what the PAD service, Proactive Persistent Adversary Detection Service, does. The information protection type of service looks at how do you classify information? Does your company have an information classification strategy? Do you know where your most sensitive information is, such as the HR database? You know, if it's PII, it's going to be regulated for most customers. And so, the disclosure of PII is going to force you to disclose an attack publicly, right? The loss of control of PII, especially for your customers. I'm not exactly sure how the rules work if it's disclosing your own employees' information, but nonetheless, it's bad. So what information protection is designed to do is really focus on those key assets and come up with security technologies or strategies where you protect that information really better than anything else. It's your most sensitive information. You should have the most strong protections on that. It might be two-factor access in the HR admin case. It might be locking that server down with IPsec. There might be deploying a rights management service. It really is it's a planning exercise about how do you find the information, how do you classify it, and then how do you protect it. Okay? So in the case of Active Directory admins in particular, attackers always go after the admin accounts. If they can find an admin account that's running as a service, that's great. But they go after the domain admin user accounts and the domain admin user clients. So if you can protect the domain admin account and the domain admin client better than anything else at the same level that you protect your domain controllers, then you're going to really have a strong defense. And so that tiered model, right, it can't be the case that one client compromises your entire Active Directory. But it could be if you run a service as domain admin on all your systems. It can't be the case that one server will compromise all of the entire domain, right, in Active Directory. So what you want is this tiered strategy, and that's what we're doing with what's called the Privileged Account Workstation or the Enhanced Security Admin Environment, PAW and ESAE. So I highly recommend the talk that just finished by Mark Simos and Nick Nicola from our team because they go into great detail. We'll show you just the high-level overview in a few minutes.
So what should the customer do if they're under attack?
Sorry.
So what should the customer do if they're under attack?
Good question. If they're under attack, over here, we have the Global Business Support Security Team. It's a 24/7 team. It's actually free support, certainly free if you're on Premier. But even if you're not under on a Premier contract, you can still file a support case. If you're under attack, they will help you. As far as I know, they don't charge for their services. You may have to sign up and say, and there's a slide in a few minutes about, you know, signing up for a support case and be willing to commit that charge per case. But if you actually are under attack, then there's going to be no charge.
Is there a minimum for getting the support?
Yeah, it's different. If it's a consumer or end user case, it's different. They go through one line. If you have at least 10 Windows systems in your network, and does everybody have 10 Windows systems? Does anybody not have 10? Okay, it's a pretty low bar. So GBSSEC will help anybody with 10 systems or more. So. Anyway, so GBSSEC is there all the time. The TAM normally would open the case for you. You have to open it as a security investigation case that will put it in a special queue. They will treat that with the utmost confidentiality. We don't create a SEV-A case because that raises alarms. For example, if you're familiar with the terminology, that's the most critical case. So what it is it goes straight into the GBSSEC investigation queue, and they're going to help you investigate what's going on. Okay? So if it's serious and you need on-site help, then that's when the cybersecurity incident response team would be dispatched. All right. And Steve, you're on the incident response team.
I am. Yeah.
Excellent.
So they'll send me.
Question.
If you see me, it's probably bad days.
Taking questions.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So at this point, there's one more. Whoops. I don't know why. There we go. One more thing we wanted to talk about, and that is now that we've investigated the attack, we figure out all accounts and all systems that are compromised. What do you do about it? Well, it turns out you're going to have to rebuild systems that the attacker has actually logged onto or put tools on. So that might be 30 systems, it might be 100 systems, it might be just 5. There's usually a pretty detailed planning exercise that you need to go through, and we call that tactical recovery. So it's planning first, and then it's actual execution of what the strategy is to regain control. Because usually you're going to put that strategy in place all at once. You don't want to just reset accounts and not rebuild systems. Or if you reset accounts and don't better protect yourself against recompromise, then you really haven't done anything, right? If you reset accounts and you haven't found the implant that's sitting over in the HR department, they're just going to steal the account again, and you're back in the same boat a few months later. So when we started, we actually worked with a customer that had persistent infections. And by rebuilding and resetting accounts at the same time and putting that infrastructure in place, that was an effective way to have long-term success and not have the attacker come back. Okay, so we call that tactical recovery. So I wanted to take a moment here and ask for questions. Is anything that you've seen caused you to have some concerns, or just in general maybe some more questions about how we do this stuff? We're going to drill into a little bit more detail for each one of these. Okay? Anybody? Not yet? Okay. We'll keep going. So I'll take a step back. And talk about Microsoft Services as a whole just for a second. We are the largest division in Microsoft with about 20,000 employees working across 191 countries and 46 different languages. Folks like myself, 6,000 consultants and architects. Joe, as a premier field engineer, 5,000 strong and growing, of course. So there's a tremendous network of folks that we can draw when we're faced with a problem and some particular customer configuration is a challenge. We can't reveal the details of the customer, but we can ask about these kinds of problems to help really quickly figure out what's going on. So that's one of the advantages of working with us on Premier. Premier is really a top-end service. If you didn't have Premier before, then you should understand Premier is really targeted to the global and enterprise customers, right? It's high-end support for these type of customers that are really have a lot at stake, and they have massive infrastructure and need top-end experts to come in and help them. It's also there to help mid-market customers, and mid-market, as far as we could determine, was about 10 million up to 1 billion in revenue and perhaps 250 clients or more. So if you're in an organization that's smaller than that, absolutely, you can have a Premier agreement. There's no problem. It's just normally those are the type of customers that Premier would be active in helping. There are other types of Premier agreements. If you're a software development organization, for example, you can get Premier support just for developers. But I don't want to spend too much time on that because we have a lot more to cover. Okay, so Joe, can you tell us a little bit about the Premier agreements, what's in them?
Sure. So some of the components of Premier agreements, and most of you, I think, should be familiar with this, is you get a technical account manager. Technical account manager is your point of contact with Microsoft. He takes your escalations to get your services, as well as works with you on planning what's going to be in your future Premier agreements. Do you have enough support hours? Are you getting the right services for your environment? As well, you have problem resolution service hours. These are the break-fix hours. It's broken. I need to talk to someone on the phone to get it fixed. Or it's been broken too long. We need to get a Premier field engineer on site to help us with it. There are support assistance hours, which can be used for a number of things in your environment. For example, training and workshops, things like that. Also, some of you, I think, are here on converted support assistance hours attending Tech Ed. So they're very flexible. It can be used for a number of different things. Workshops are always available to you as a Premier customer. You can either prepay for those hours in advance and use them throughout your contract term, or you can buy those ad hoc as well.
And we have a lot of different workshops. I mean, we have everything from like Microsoft Forensics to also working, working into how to deploy software patches, et cetera. So it's it's quite a large range, and they're open and closed too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, if you can think of a Microsoft technology, there are workshops available for most of those technologies, and some of the security things that you might not think of, we do have workshops for as well. All right, so other components of the Premier agreement, there are two types of Premier field engineers. There are the transactional Premier field engineers like myself. We generally visit different customers every week. We are experts in our technology, but we don't stay with one customer for a very long period of time, though we'll often return to the same customer over and over again, either working on the same technology or related technologies. Then there's dedicated support engineers who only have one large customer, or they may have several mid-sized customers. Generally, you have to have a minimum of 400 hours to have a dedicated support engineer. They're experts in a particular technology as well. The difference between them and a transactional engineer is that you have a direct line to your DSE. You can pick up on the phone and call them about something that's not related to break fix, or you can email them directly. You have their direct email. You do have all that same contact for a transactional engineer, but likely after the transactional engineer has left you, he's probably on site working with another customer. So if you want that dedicated level of support where you can just pick up the phone and say, hey, I want to deploy direct access. What can you tell me about it? A dedicated support engineer might be great. That might be one of the things that he handles. Or you might say, I have a question about LDAP 3.0. We're deploying a new application. There are also remote advisory hours. These are services where I don't need somebody to come on site and work with us directly. We just need to talk with them. I do those anywhere from 30 minutes with a customer up to, it might cover 2 or 3 days in a row, or 2 or 3 days spread out over several weeks or several months. This allows customers to have working sessions with us where they can actually get some knowledge. It could be anything from a chalk talk to just an open session about a particular type of technology. There's also on-demand training available. That's simply an add-on to your Premier agreement. It's a one-time fee, and you have the whole catalog of training videos available that you can then ad hoc look at any member of your IT staff. And of course, there's access to other special service offerings, some of which we're talking about here today.
Right, so for the folks that do have Premier, were you familiar with all of these components? If you're the Premier owner, you probably would be, but not everybody knows all of these components. And that's, again, this is why I'm pretty excited to talk about this, because every time I go and talk to a customer, probably one-third of my job is helping educate customers on security problems and what they can do about them. The other third is developing solutions and then delivering. Customers didn't know about these things. So we kind of really wanted to have this talk and at least get the word out and let people know these are the things that you have to work with. So if you're doing on-site work, right, then some of the on-site work you can do, as Joe mentioned, of course, is training and labs. But you can also, we've got one that's Active Directory Recovery Execution Services, where you go in the lab and you actually recover your own production environment in the lab. And you go through all the steps, and you make sure that you can actually recover your production AD from whatever backups you're using. More than likely, you'll find some problem, right? And then you'll fix it. And then, you know, within a week, you've already found, you know, something which would have been disastrous after an attack where you can't recover.
Yeah. And the AD recovery execution is actually an excellent example, because not only do you build your own documentation with the assistance of an expert PFE and Active Directory, but the end result is, guess what? You've now got a working duplicate copy of your Active Directory in a lab environment that you can now redeploy anytime you need, as well as use for testing and QA before you deploy applications to production. So it was a really good example, William.
Right. So there is a difference between what the types of services that that we can do under a support contract and the type of services we can do under a professional services or consulting agreement. And that is typically, if you think about it, support is there to help you do what you need to do, right? So they're not actually going to do hands-on implementation in production. We would expect them to transfer all the knowledge, do everything in the lab. They can do that hands-on. When it comes to touching your production network, you know, that's kind of the drawing line, right? If you need someone to actually implement in production, that's going to be a consultant. If you need someone who's going to do everything but implement in production, then that would be the support engineer, okay? So the other little difference is that if it's brand new systems that we're designing for customers, that's typically going to be a professional services agreement, a consultant, versus a support engineer. Okay, so it's a small line, but sometimes it's important when you get into, say, recovery and you've got to completely do a brand new environment. That's probably not, that's going to, you know, stretch the bounds of really what we can do under support. Okay, thanks. So when we talk about the types of offerings under Premier, we keep adding more and more all the time, but generally we've got six different categories. You know, you can see them there, but I want to focus just on pretty much two, the response capability, the respond capability, and the assessment and architecture ones. So when we get into response, I'm going to turn it over to our incident responder here in a second. But as I mentioned, consumer-level support, and I didn't want to do this talk and then end up with a whole bunch of end users saying, hey, I need help. End-user support, directly end-user support, you just go to the website there. They're going to ask you to run the Microsoft Safety Scanner, which is an awesome scanner. It's a command-line scanner. We'll check for antivirus using the public signature set. And then if they still need help, you submit a web form, and they'll call you back and get in touch with you.
So before we move on, William, Everybody take note of this slide, because while you may be IT implementers, you're probably also the IT support personnel for your own family and friends. This is where you need to refer them so you can get out of the business of being family and friend IT support when they have a security incident.
As far as I understand, there's also no charge for this support if there is a malware infection found. Okay. All right. So again, if you're an IT pro or a small business, you can use one of your Microsoft partners to provide support, or you can file a support case directly online. I walked through the steps here just to be sure I understood how to do it. But basically, if you walk through these steps, and when you get the slides, you'll see the detail, there's a special way to look and say the problem type is a security incident, and then you classify the type of security incident. That will get it into the GBSSEC queue, okay? Because GBSSEC is the focus point for all incident response and investigation at Microsoft. Again, it's 24/7 global service, and then if they need to escalate, they'll escalate, okay? So, you know, fill out the form, and eventually you get down. Now, you can pay for it in lots of different ways. You can pay for it off some type of support contract that you already have, or a credit card, what have you, or even an MSDN subscription. So it's actually pretty flexible. When it comes to GBSSEC, GBSSEC, oh, hang on, yes, sir? The question was cloud versus? Okay. The question is, is cloud support broken down separately from on-premise support, right? And the answer is no. GBSSEC would still handle all security investigation no matter what part of the Microsoft infrastructure or services you're using. Now, they will pull in experts from, say, Office 365 and Azure, but they are the focal point. So you still go to GBSSEC as your one point of contact for Microsoft support for security incident investigation, okay? Okay, so as I mentioned, as long as you have at least 10 PCs, GBSSEC is the solution. They are the coordinators for the investigation. Whoops, excuse me. If you have a Premier agreement, you can have a PFE, a security engineer who's specialized in security investigation, come and help you on site. That is the one area where they can do hands-on work in your production environment to help you collect logs. And then either way, if you have a Premier agreement or you don't have a Premier agreement, you can engage the Microsoft cybersecurity team. And when we respond, if you have a Premier agreement, we can respond under Premier. If you don't have one, we just respond under a professional services consulting agreement. Okay? So when do you engage? Anytime you have reasonable suspicion. Right? So if you reasonably expect that there might be a compromise or some kind of attack against you, open a case. Right? They're there to help you. And if you have a Premier agreement, again, it's going to be non-decrement to you for that security investigation. So, you know, the idea here, as you can see, they want to answer a couple different questions, you know, really give you a full scope. How did the incident occur? What happened? What is the damage? And what do I do next? They're really just there to help you. They're phone support, right? But they're there to help you confidently handle the situation and understand the situation that you're faced with. Okay? So I mentioned this already. One of the things they're going to do is give you what's called a WOLF tool. The WOLF tool is a live forensics tool. It runs on a running system and collects a bunch of log information, and they're going to give you a user ID and password to upload that information so they can analyze it in the background. So that is one case where information has to come off your network, go to GBSSEC. They have a very high security environment that they keep that. The data is automatically deleted after a period of time. As carefully as they can manage that. But basically, what it's going to do is time sequence all the information, all the activities that have happened on the machine, and look at anomalies, right? So there's a bunch of back-end processing that analyzes that data. So it's not a tool that we can really release, per se, because if we released it, then the attackers would have it. But the client side, the log collection part, is a release tool. It expires in 10 days after you get it, okay? So that's what it means to use GBSSEC for investigation. They give you a log collection tool, you upload the data, they analyze it, and they tell you whether or not the machine they think is compromised, or they ask for some more information. Okay, and you can do WOLF analysis on a bunch of different machines, but it's not like an antivirus scan. It's a time-intensive process. The engineer is probably going to spend an hour or two looking through that data. So in that case, it is more like a forensic examination, but it's quite fast from a forensics perspective. Most forensic investigations might take 1 or 2 days per machine. So WOLF has been really a much big improvement, I guess, on that. Okay. So lastly, if we've determined that there is some type of problem with the customer's machine, then you've got to contain the threat. There's advice on that. And again, it's as much support as you need to help contain that incident. Okay. So from a Premier field engineer perspective, you know, they are really your on-site advisor and your liaison to the rest of the Microsoft security system behind, you know, what I'm showing you today. It's actually quite complicated. There's a lot of different players. There's Trustworthy Computing Center. There's Microsoft Malware Protection Center. There's GBSSEC. There's cybersecurity. So we try to make sure that the technical account manager doesn't have to deal with that per se, but the on-site Premier field engineer can. Because they understand everything that goes on behind the scenes. All right. So finally, I'm going to turn this over to Steve, because Steve is actually on the incident response team for the cyber team, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so as was said earlier, I'm on the IR team, the cyber IR team. And for this slide to just discuss about how we look at cyber intrusions, we really can do things proactively or reactively. Reactively, we'd call it an IR, and we're going to send people on site to start analyzing data. And it's going to be a very dynamic environment, as you can expect. Proactively, we have the Persistent Adversary Detection Services, or PADS. That's pretty much like a mini IR controlled situation. You know we're coming, et cetera. And we'll talk specifically on that here on this next slide. But they really follow the same rough methodology, is that we're going to send a team of 4 people for pretty much a starting time of about 5 days. During that time, we're going to look at up to 50,000 machines. And we have special tools to be able to analyze your network. We will travel with this 4-person team, as I said earlier. We'll have a senior person that's designed to keep track of what's going on, the flow, the rhythm of the engagement. We'll have attack analysts. We have a person that's looking for that's doing the forensics, the WOLF data analysis. That's usually what I'm doing, and looking for anomalies and malware and tools. We also travel with a reverse engineer, and that's really one of the cool things about this team is that if someone finds some specific piece of code, we may not know what it is. I mean, We're not designed or we're not engineered to find stuff that antivirus has already found. We don't care about that. We're looking for the new stuff, the stuff that you don't know about. And that's where we really excel, is that we can find a piece of interesting code, and we can have it on site, you know, looked at, reversed, and even potentially, you know, share that with antivirus vendors while we're there, and signatures built while we're there. And so really what you get out of the IR, during an IR or a PADS, depending on if you're proactive or reactive, is you're going to get a list of, you know, what's going on, how is it happening, as well as the high-level roadmap and what the next steps are for that. And some of our methods of what we're looking for, we're looking for specific custom implants. We're looking for someone who's attacking you specifically, and they're going to do some cool things, like make sure that no antivirus detects this new piece of code. So we're looking for that piece, and then we're going to do forensics on the box, see how it got on there as well. We do some host memory analysis for malicious code, and obviously, like I said earlier, reverse engineering. And then we also, with permission from you all, if we can get the IP address range from you, we can see if there's a lot of attacks coming from outside in or inward outward using some sensor intelligence. Which we'll talk about that with our CTI infrastructure. So, William?
Yeah, sure. So one of the first things we had to do on the cybersecurity team was use the information that we already were collecting to help customers. I mean, that just made sense. So what we were able to do is take we have to have customer permission, of course, and the customer provides their source IP range, and we query across all the data that we've been collecting for pretty much the last year. That's kind of where we cut it off, because maybe stuff even older than that's not very relevant. But basically, if we look across all the different antivirus products, if you're using one of these antivirus products, it may be reporting in, and the source IP is retained. Everything else is anonymized, but the source IP is retained. And so that's a way that we can sort of say, you know, out of your network, we saw this type of threat reported. There's a randomized, basically a GUID in there that you'll have to figure out how to map that back to the specific machine, because it's anonymized, we can't tell at all. The other thing that Bing is doing, in addition to being a search engine, of course, it's out there scanning and indexing and caching content, but it has special algorithms in there to look for malicious code, malicious websites that are being used as attack websites. So when we see interesting things in your proxy logs, for example, doing an investigation, we can go and find out what Bing has seen at that site before and look back in time. The last thing is that the Digital Crimes Unit, you may have heard about, they just opened a cybersecurity center. But they're very active in basically taking down botnets. They study the botnets that are out there in the world. They maintain a database of clients. They maintain a database of command and control servers. And so when our team is helping a customer investigate, we check with them to say, have you seen any botnet activity from this customer? Because if that's there, then you know the type of actor that you're dealing with. Okay? So again, looking across all of that information, we can do a report for a customer and not only tell them what we've seen out of their network, but the similar types of activity that we've seen around the world. And so this is the way that we can really tell whether it's targeted or not. If we find something malicious in your environment, we can go into the Malware Protection Center and say, hey, have you guys ever seen this kind of code or this type of hash on a file anywhere? This name of a file, we can query on all kinds of things to see where else in the world it's been used. Now, we can't say where it's been used necessarily. We can't attribute another customer, but we can say we've seen it in financial, we've seen it in this country, so that you have an idea of the type of actor that is attacking you, okay? So when it comes to attack recovery, we break it down into three areas. We talked about incident response a little bit. We talked a little bit about tactical recovery, and that's the detailed planning for when we find things, how do you regain control? What is our strategy to regain control? How do we get a project plan together, and how do we sequence all the resources and have a specific date where we can just regain, you know, put in all the systems that we've rebuilt and reset passwords, what have you. So that's the tactical recovery. It's going to take somewhere between 2 and 12 weeks, depending on how serious the attack is. Now, first, there's another phase called strategic recovery that most customers who have had very serious attacks will have to go into eventually. And so if you're going to rebuild an entire environment, let's say they took over Exchange, or they took over SCCM, or they took over your Link servers, or took over your DMZ, you're going to have to do a lot of rebuilding. So it's not just enough to just regain control, but you're going to have to actually get onto a more safe environment. Even with our tools and techniques, we're never really sure right? Especially in the older systems where they could have updated the BIOS. We're never really sure that the attacker does not have control of these things until we rebuild them from scratch. So that's, you know, it's a lot of work, but in some cases that's just the known safe way to recover. So that's what we would consider strategic recovery. We might also take a little bit of time, I'll show you in a minute what we're doing for credential theft. Putting in place some of these credential theft, like changing your service account architecture, that's going to take some time. I've seen customers with hundreds of service accounts, and they can work through those service accounts, you know, every month, but it's going to take them a year. So we would consider that a strategic type of project. Okay, when we talk about recovery, this is probably one of the most important slides that I could present to you, because most customers are not doing recovery very well, at least from what we've seen. It's not enough to reset accounts, as I said. It's not enough to just look at some small system rebuilds. You have to be able to know all the systems and all the accounts that the attacker had control over, and then have a way of regaining that control. So generally speaking, that's going to rebuild all those systems and reset all those accounts, or create brand new accounts and just disable or delete the old accounts. So obviously there's some planning there. But you don't want to rebuild systems that have the same vulnerabilities that were there in the first place. That's often what customers don't do. They don't increase their defenses. They just rebuild what was already there. They restore from backup. So without changing the defensive posture of the systems, you're just going to probably get recompromised again. You also want to be able to detect the compromising better than you did before, right? Now that you know so much about it and you've paid for the investigation, let's actually increase the detective capabilities of our logging, of our proxy, of our internal security teams. That's where we see most customers' focus is on better detection. But detection is too late, right? It's necessary, but it's too late. Okay. And then lastly, in a lot of these attacks, and you see this in the published reports, it takes customers months, at least months, to finish a formal investigation. If they're a regulated industry, they may have to have a formal report out to the executives or to the board of directors about what happened, why did it happen, right? And what kind of damage. That kind of investigation takes a long time. There's a lot of information that may be required. There may be many teams required to come in forensically and track that down in a way which is final and conclusive. So some customers don't worry about it, but if you're in a regulated industry, this preserving information strategy is important. We have some customers that had to retain hundreds of systems, just the disks from hundreds of systems, and then go analyze them to see if there was a compromise on them. I mean, it can be a big task. Think of e-discovery across a large infrastructure. Okay, so some of the really cool stuff that you haven't seen before, I'm pretty sure, is in our proactive defenses. So let me get started with that. So let's talk about the RAP, risk assessment as a program.
Yeah, so starting about 12, 13 years ago, Microsoft Premier Field Engineers came up with the idea, hey, we've got these customers using our technologies, and you know we're responding to the same customers for the same types of incidents and same types of problems. We need to come up with a proactive delivery where we can get the customers ahead of the ball before things have critically failed and help them identify health issues and risk issues with those technologies. They started out originally called health checks. As they matured, they became risk assessment programs. Now we've moved to the next level with cloud computing, and now they are risk assessment programs as a service, or RAS. If you can see the list of technologies for which some of these are available. Traditionally, with the health checks and the risk assessment programs, the engineer would come on site with a tool set, do the data collection, do knowledge transfer with you, the customer. Depending on the size of the environment, it might be a minimum of 3 days. If you're a very large environment, it might be a custom engagement of more than 7 days. Well, now in today's time, you know, that's very heavy for a customer to dedicate 3 days, 5 days, or 2 weeks to just work on a particular thing with a particular engineer. There are lots of things going on as IT implementers. We've got to do a lot of different things. We have to sit with an engineer and work with them day in, day out for 8 hours. That's very time consuming, takes away from other projects. Now, with the RAS, you can download the analysis tool set yourself. You don't have to wait for the engineer to come on site. Run the data collection at your leisure. When it's completed for the particular technology, you upload that to Microsoft. It's then assigned to an expert engineer who then runs the analysis and reporting, then sets up a meeting with you and the TAM to review the findings. It's online, it's on demand. The Microsoft Security RAS is an example of that. And as they mentioned, the MSRA before, it's a lightweight version of the MSRA.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
Sure.
So as Joe mentioned, the MSRA is Microsoft Security Risk Assessment. That is our flagship security assessment for enterprise customers and mid-market customers. What we're really doing there is spending as little time as possible out of your staff's time to be very efficient at finding the types of capabilities that you don't quite have there in order to defend or recover from a cyber attack. It's really cyber attack focused. It's not a security compliance. It's not really a best practice measurement or best practice comparison. It's looking at the capabilities of your organization in 11 different areas, to withstand or, defend against, withstand, and recover from cyber attack. So the way we deliver this is we have two architects on site. We do a lot of planning ahead of time, but basically we get two architects on site for a week. They go through about 20 to 30 different meetings with different staff members from implementer engineer level all the way up to senior management. And we're trying to really look at the capabilities from a people, process, and technology perspective. It's agnostic across platforms. It's not Windows specific.
And we see this bundled a lot with the proactive adversary detection service as well.
Right. So. We don't have any hands-on tools. We're not checking system configurations, right? So the best of both worlds is to have the MSRA as an overall IT risk assessment coupled with the deep hands-on inspection of an Active Directory security assessment or a persistent adversary detection service, PADS. Okay. So at this point, can you drill just a little bit more into Active Directory security?
Yeah, so the offline security assessment for Active Directory is really near and dear to me. It's really hot off the press offering. We just certified 7 new engineers 2 weeks ago to deliver this, as well as upgraded 6 of our previous Active Directory security assessment certified engineers to deliver this. This is the hands-on, the engineer brings the tool set to you. This is a side-by-side, you have to dedicate this. The offline assessment is more like the classic wrap. You need to be dedicated for this. We look at over 800 items related to Active Directory security. These include settings of the OS configuration for the domain controller, as well as security settings, configurations, group memberships within the Active Directory itself, whether or not your firewall is on, what type of network configuration you're using, who's a member of the privileged access group, such as domain admins and enterprise admins, where those accounts are coming from, trust relationships you've established. Often attacks may not originate within your Active Directory forest, but they may come in through a trusted domain because there's a two-way trust there. The engineer runs the data collection set with you. We collect back these settings. There's also a survey component where we ask you about how you do your IT operations and security operations that's related to Active Directory. Once we have the data from both the survey as well as the hard data from the domain controllers themselves and the Active Directory, we run through an analysis component, which analyzes and tells us what are the key findings. Then we take those and we generate a report. We get several reports. One of them is the key findings report. What are items are at high risk in your environment and need to be actioned very soon? We use the red light, yellow light, green light, blue light. Red meaning you need to take care of this now. If you're not already compromised, you're at risk of becoming compromised very soon. And then, from there it goes out near-term actions and long-term actions as well.
We have a sample report if you want to come up afterwards and take a look at this. Really what it's designed to do is help you improve. So if you do it this year and you do it next year, you can compare the difference and see the benefits.
Exactly. You want to see that you're improving. Typically, one of the key things that I find when I do these types of engagements with customers is that they've had domain controllers that have been around for 10 years, built by different people at different times with different standards. They're running on different OS levels. None of them are built the same. None of the security settings are the same. And more importantly, the security settings that are there that will be helpful are not applied, say, via GPL. They're simply ad hoc configured in the registry. You want to have consistent settings, which will apply to the domain controllers so that you have a consistent view of the security across those domain controllers. We don't have a slide for it, but then that's where the hardening Active Directory using the Security Compliance Manager comes in. We take the output from this report, we sit down with you again side by side, do a lot of knowledge transfer, and help you build the baseline for what you want the security to look like for your Active Directory environment.
Right. If you think about domain controllers, right, they're always accessible to everybody on the network, whether you're part of the domain or not. I mean, it's the most attackable type of asset that you've got, and it's the most, pretty much the most sensitive asset you have.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let me cover real quickly the last type of assessment that we do, which is an assessment for developers, essentially, development organizations. But even if you're an IT organization, you probably do a lot of software development, or you contract out for software to be delivered to you. Say, for example, an HR system or a front-end web-facing service. You might want to have somebody take a look at the security of that system in a deep way. Do a code review or do a threat model, for example. Threat modeling is looking at the design of the application and figuring out how it might be attacked and how it defends against attacks. Or just look at your practices through your software organization in the seven different type of software development lifecycle phases. How am I doing against best practices? So we call that a gap assessment. So we've got Michael Howard on our team who wrote Writing Secure Code and helped develop the security development lifecycle in Windows with me back when I was on the product team in 2000. And also develop the security development lifecycle for Office. So now he helps do training. You can get even a very small amount of training for, say, 1 or 3 days, just focused on the kind of development that your teams do. If it's .NET, we'll train and talk about security in .NET code and not worry about kernel code. If you're doing kernel drivers or what have you, then we'll focus on the kernel area. So we've got a good team of folks that do that. So I want to get to the pass the hash type of defense. And I think I'm going to turn that over to you, Steve.
Thank you. it actually makes sense.
Seeing as how you developed the solution.
Since it's sort of kind of my baby, and I like to cradle the slam engagement in my arms. So starting late last year, I guess, is a little history since I have a few minutes to talk. We saw a lot of pass the hash attacks, and there's lots of different methods, and CyberArk and other third-party products are out there trying to fix this problem as well. We decided, let's see how hard it is for us to real quickly take some of the published solutions out there from other Microsoft developers and pack this up into something that would be beneficial for you all and provide you an increased level of protection. And after many iterations of the offering, we decided to call this thing called SLAM. And really what we're doing here is we're trying to do a couple things. We're really focusing on the lateral movement, and I think I mentioned that earlier. If I can own a specific machine and they all have the same local admin passwords, then I can go to every machine, because I'm an admin now on everybody's machine, because I can harvest the hash and the credentials. So we definitely want to stop that, and this solution is designed to stop that piece right there, because if I can change and randomize everybody's password, then we only are dealing with a one infection client as opposed to an enterprise infection at that point.
Local admin password.
Of local admin password. Right. So that's that's really the basis part of what SLAM does, is it randomizes your local admin password and uploads that into Active Directory into an extended confidential attribute. And we also provide side-by-side training on GPO restrictions, logon or access to compute for the network. We do some UAC stuff. If you're running Vista clients or later, we do some token filtering, et cetera. And really the goal of the SLAM engagement is to get you started in your journey for randomizing passwords and preventing credential, elevation of privilege through credential theft.
Right. So how long does it take?
So it's a 3-day engagement. Probably 2.5 now that we've been running it for a while, and we work side by side to help build a lab and help you to work through the process of that.
And support assistance hours for that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's a premier offering. So whichever hours you want to use, you can do that.
Okay. Great. So there's a little bit more to the pass the hash defense, and this goes to Mark and Nick's talk earlier. When we look at the overall architecture in an enterprise, and this is something that you're not going to get to quickly, but perhaps over the course of a year, you can go from where you are today to this type of architecture, and this is our recommended architecture for credential theft mitigation. It's a difficult problem because, of course, you've got service accounts, you've got lots of admins, you've got admins of servers, you've got admins of workstations, you've got admins of domain. You really have to look at the whole problem of admin control. So what we try to do is separate things out into three tiers. So to the top tier is the control of a domain controller. Anything which can control a domain controller, can install software on a domain controller, can run services on a domain controller, that's in that tier. So that includes the clients that are doing domain admin. And that's where most folks kind of don't think about that. They manage their domain with the same client that they browse the internet with and do email on and read documents on. Well, that's where the attacks are. So why would you manage your domain with the same client that is most at risk of being attacked? So the recommendation in the Pass the Hash white paper is fairly simple. It says, hey, let's put your admins on a dedicated client, a dedicated physical client. You can't, it's not good enough to sort of remote in to a safe client, because if you're coming from a compromised client, then it's compromised. You have to have a known, safe, good physical client from known safe media, right? So I've seen attackers compromise enterprise images, go into SCCM operating system deployment and compromise the image. I've seen them go into the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit and compromise the image. So you can't necessarily trust the images that are laying around in your enterprise and install a brand new client. You've got to start from scratch, from known good media, and it's got to be different than all the other clients. Otherwise, it's not. It might share some kind of commonality that could be used to compromise it. So what we're doing is a couple different things here. So the first thing, as Steve mentioned, is we're going to implement lateral traversal mitigation so that you can't, if you take over one client, you can't take over another client. That can be as simple as turning on the Windows firewall or the McAfee firewall or Symantec firewall, whatever host firewall you've got. The recommendation is turn it on. Block this traffic that goes peer-to-peer unless you know that the application is safe. So for example, the Link client does remote desktop between clients, desktop sharing, but the type of credential that it uses does not expose a credential theft risk. It's actually a token for the Link session, essentially. So you can have peer-to-peer traffic. You just have to look at the types of credentials that are exposed. All right. So firewall protections and login restrictions that SLAM addresses is part of the problem, or part of the solution, rather. The next thing you need to do is tackle the service account problem. Now, we call service account problem something, application and server or service hardening, because you really have to get into the details of the application. How does it use that service account? You can't just take a service account that's running as local admin and make it not run as local admin, because it might need the privilege of local admin. You'll break the service, or you'll break the application. So unfortunately, it's a pretty painstaking process. You may not even be able to change the password. It might have a baked-in password of some sort that the application knows. So you have to study these service accounts pretty carefully, and that's why it's a hard problem. Now, to protect domain admins better than anything else, we've presented this before. I believe Mark did a talk at TechEd last year. But basically, what we do is we set up a brand new forest that is using the latest technology that is secured as best as we can secure it. A brand new forest contains not only the domain admin accounts, but the domain admin clients. So it's a dedicated forest that is used only by the domain admins. And there's a one-way trust from production to this admin forest so that there really is no exposure of the account except on domain controllers. We actually whitelist all the code that runs on this environment with AppLocker. We whitelist the connections that the client can make so that the client can only connect to the domain controller level. So that way you don't have an accidental login to a server or an accidental login to a client. Again, it seems extreme, but this is two domain controllers, right, as a forest, as a standalone single domain forest, and then you put the domain admin clients in that forest. In our solution, we have smart card only accounts, and we have System Center Operations Manager to act as a security monitor looking for malicious behavior, right? We also auto-patch the environment. As soon as a patch is released, pretty much within the day, the patch is deployed. So if you see that kind of blue line around the box there, that blue line represents an IPsec isolation barrier. There's no network traffic into that environment that's not IPsec. So within that environment, they're completely locked down. The systems talk amongst themselves just fine. They're IPsec either authenticated or encrypted. And you can even turn on IPsec so that the client traffic to the production domain, your domain admin traffic, potentially your most sensitive traffic, is all IPsec encrypted and authenticated. So again, we know how to do this. This is the level at which I think if you're really going to defend long-term against targeted attacks on your domain admins, this is the kind of solution that you need. Okay? So what about all the other server admins? Well, we have a solution called Privileged Account Workstation that we're just coming out with. We'll start delivering this in July. That is a design that we've developed internally. We've deployed it now to thousands of admins, and we can pretty much build this fairly quickly. So it's a highly secure Windows 8.1 client, and it's used as a server admin workstation or a help desk workstation. Okay. The next thing we want to do, you've probably heard of credential vaulting. Everybody heard of credential vaulting, privileged account management tools, right, where you get a temporary account or something like that. Well, we have something similar. It's called the Managed Access Request System. This is coming out again in July for FY15. It's based on the Forefront Identity Manager product, FIM. What it does is create a workflow inside FIM so that you say, I need a domain admin account, in this case, a server admin account or a help desk account. And for a temporary period of time, it'll elevate the privilege of an existing account and then take that privilege away when you're done or automatically, right? So you say, I need it for 2 hours, and it'll take it away. Or you can say, I need it for 2 hours, and you're done with it. In an hour, you can go de-escalate it. So it's temporary admin credentials, right, or temporary admin privilege, actually, is the way it's implemented. Now, that's good, okay? That's infrastructure you can deploy today if you've got basically Windows XP and later. All of that was deployable under Windows XP and later. If you really want to go to the next level, the Windows 8.1 and Windows Server 2012 R2 features to make pass the hash more difficult are there. Mark Rusinovich has talked about them. Mark and Nick's talk just prior talked about them. But there's things that we have done in the operating system which reduce the chance of credential theft. And of course, we have to, right? We have to make our systems more and more secure to adapt to the threat. So this particular arrow is showing the ability that when I remote desktop into a system, I can tell that remote desktop session not to expose a hash of my password on the remote system. So now help desk can remote in safely to any system it needs to, right, as local admin without fear that credential is going to get stolen. So that was a big scenario to accomplish. The other thing over there is creating users that don't have a hash of their password laying around. They're Kerberos-only users or NTLM-less users, right? That really wasn't possible before, but you can use a feature called Protected Users to accomplish that. Okay, so that's a couple of the different things that we're doing. There's even something when you get to an Active Directory that's Server 2012 R2 and you have systems that are running at Server 2012 R2 or Windows 8, point one, you can implement what's called authentication policies or authentication silos. That actually tells you, I want this account to connect to me from this machine, right? That's kind of what we were doing with the admin forest. We were saying, domain admins can only use their particular dedicated client in that forest to do domain admin, but this is a way of generically configuring the domain to say, I want logins to come from a specific machine in addition to a specific user. All right. So anyway, I know that's a little bit complicated, but all of these capabilities are now available as you go to later systems. And that's why when we build this Red Forest, we use the latest technology. We used to build it with Server 2008 R2 and Windows 7. That's still an option, but we prefer 2012 R2 and Windows 8.1. Okay, so let me talk just a second about Emmet. I'm going to turn it back to Steve because Steve's actually implemented the solution for Emmet. I think we've got a little bit. I've got 1 minute and 40 seconds.
No pressure.
We'll see how fast
no
you
pressure.
Can go.
Gonna bring up the rear, I guess.
Yeah.
So Emmet, it was good to see some hands of people that have deployed it, and you should totally deploy that, especially at your home computers if you have little kids like me. Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. It's free. You can specify specific mitigations to what you want to patch for. And it's really designed to be a wrapper around applications to look for behaviors such as that appear to be malicious. And I'll actually talk about the TSA analogy. I like to call them it's like the TSA, and I guess the good part of TSA, which is we have an X-ray machine. We got to figure out, okay, this thing looks bad. We identify that this water bottle here is more than 3 ounces, so that's obviously bad. So we have to block this stuff. So we have specific mitigations we can do. And you can probably guess where we really want to target. We want to target PDF readers, we want to target Java, we want to target your browser, we want to target Office applications as well. So to help you with that, we have a side-by-side where we'll help you understand what the mitigations are, help you deploy it, et cetera. And so it's actually a pretty good primer on using Emmet and deploying it, learning about the policies, et cetera. There's also one other component, it's not really on the slide, called Emmet Reporting Services. So if you actually want to report upon Emmet and see how it's working in the environment, you could deploy something like Emmet Reporting Services, have a group of folks come out and architect that solution for you. So I'm going to go really quickly, but pretty much you just get information back from your application event log, and we can bubble that up into one big report for you.
Okay, thanks. We're going to skip over this particular slide because we're right here at the end of time, and just recommend the solution. The sessions that are coming up. These top three sessions are coming up tomorrow. You can see Hacker's Perspective on Your Windows Infrastructure, a Mandatory Checklist, Fighting Evil with Good, a great talk by TWC, and then, of course, Mark Rusinovich, Hunting Malware with Sysinternals Tools, which is highly recommended. So some of the other talks that we listed there have already happened. Definitely, if you're interested in Pass the Hash Defense, take a look at the talk that Nick and Mark just completed. They're here in the room with us, so you can follow up with them as well. That's right. Put your hands up there, guys.
Yeah.
All right.
Right there.
Fantastic. All right. So I hope this has been, I know it's been a high-level overview, but really this kind of information had not been out there about the types of activities that we're doing to help customers. Most of it's happening in the context of a Premier agreement. Not all of it has to happen under Premier. Like I said, I mean, you can contact GBS, you can get the incident response team, any number of services really we can do for you in either way. So my main point is that if you've got your Premier agreement already in place and you need some of this stuff or some of it's interesting, you know, let's have a follow-up conversation to figure out, you know, what makes sense, right? Obviously, there's a lot of stuff. It's all broken down into pieces because not everybody needs everything, all right?
Okay. And the parting shot, we have to say it. Please complete your surveys.
Yes.
And since this is brand new content, we definitely want, if you can be verbatim, just let us know how we did, what kind of things you want to know. We'd love to see it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. We'll wrap here. And we'll be up here for questions. Thanks.